I'll talk a little bit about the different parts of the brain that were engaged during those different factors, different things you were doing. How was it for you? In particular, what was it like to do the suggestions, and what benefit, if any, what work did you find in the suggestions in terms of the purpose, the steadying of the mind? How was that? Yeah? That's good. Yeah, I kind of, a good example of that for me is, as I said last night, I've done a fair amount of rock climbing, and I would sometimes watch people who are better climbers move up the rock like human geckos, and I would just sort of imagine in my own body what that would be like, and then I would do it, and I would climb better as a result. You know, there's a traditional suggestion to sit like the Buddha, where the Buddha actually would often address people as, oh, nobly born. And not everybody he was talking to was actually nobly born, but it was kind of like a way to induct people into that state of mind. So the power of bottom-up intentionality is really, really good. You know, there's a kind of a history, really, in Western psychology and philosophy of initially a sort of top-down approach that also really tended to privilege inner language as the entirety of thought. And increasingly, there's an understanding in psychology about the importance of emotional, nonverbal, and somatic processes, including more bottom-up processing. Okay, great. Any other examples of trying the suggestions, ones that really worked for you, or maybe ones that really didn't work for you? And by the way, I'll be happily sending you a PDF of these slides if you want. You just give me your email address. So, any other, yeah. Yeah.
Kind of got a very
detached.
Didn't feel good.
Right. Yeah. Got it. And I can really imagine that happening. It's more of a Tibetan Buddhist approach, you know, mind like space. It's often a cue for people, spacious awareness. But you're right, it can get kind of weirdly dualistic. You know, am I the observer of what my experience is? Or am I just here? Am I observing the awareness? And this is the space of experience, the world. A lot. The way it kind of works is just to relax into that one. And just get a sense of things appearing and disappearing. Sounds are a good one to work on, especially with the eyes closed. They appear in awareness and then they pass away. They come and they go. It's as simple as that. And that can give us a sense of spaciousness around it. I'll talk more about that one in particular later today, probably after lunch, because it's a way into not self, but a panoramic vista, however we achieve it, like a bird's eye view or the 30,000 foot view, like in an airplane, that tends to activate networks on the sides of the brain, especially in the right side. For most people, you know, right-handed people and probably half of all left-handed people that are left-side dominant for language. Anyway, these lateral networks take us out into open, spacious mindfulness. And they deactivate, when they light up, they deactivate common networks in the middle of the brain that are the so-called default network that are very involved when we're lost in thought or planning or worrying or in the future or the past. So it's kind of a trick to go to a panoramic view that takes us into these lateral networks of mindfulness. I'm just looking for what will kind of put logs, good logs on the fire, you know, using the Buddhist metaphor of causes and results. Good logs on the fire being steadiness of mind. And one of them is spacious, this sort of idea of spacious awareness. And one way into that is through this idea of a panoramic perspective. As an example, and this illustrates a larger point, that of the interconnection, really, the codependent arising of mind and brain, such that if we know something about of what's going on in the black box of the brain when the mind is in a good place, we can then use other methods or various methods to activate those neural substrates of the positive states of mind that we want to, you know, encourage. That basic strategy. Okay, yeah, right there.
Yeah,
Yeah.
Almost like, you know, in an altered state that that I was not processing the words, and when I struggle to process the words, I lose the...
Yeah. Do you experience that commonly with guided practices? Or more just this particular one?
Visualizations, I don't experience it. But visualizations I can stay with.
Yeah.
But with a lot of the words,
yeah,
I do often find myself like torn between staying up with words,
yeah,
and just losing
it. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I relate to that. I personally don't like guided practices very much. I just want the teacher to shut up. And so it's really fine if that was your experience with me. I'll try not to take it too personally. You know? I'll try to practice what I'm preaching here about non-self. That's really common and natural and understandable. So there you are going to this very deep sort of nonverbal place, and then this annoying voice comes in. Like, I'm supposed to do this thing, and it's different. And, you know, it's very natural. It's, again, turn it off if you want. It's just perfectly fine to do that. You know, on the other hand, a lot of Buddhist meditations, you know, they have pointing out instructions. You know, think of the, for example, just a simple example of the mindfulness of breathing sutta or practice in Buddhism has 16 steps in it. You know, those are 16 guided instructions in a mindfulness of breathing practice. So, you know, I think finding our own way into this, after a while we kind of internalize the words, they're just pointing out instructions. They're imperfect arrows for what we're aiming at, which is a nonverbal state of being, state of mind. And when we know what that state of mind is like, then we're kind of there. Great. Thanks for saying that. Yeah, I think you spoke for more than one person. Okay, yeah, right there. Okay, so it worked at least once.
It worked for me.
Oh, two. Great, good. I see a few other hands, too. Yeah, it kind of makes sense. It doesn't always work, but, you know, you put more logs on the fire, it's going to tend to burn more brightly. And it illustrates, in a sense, a larger point that, for me, is a very important one. In my view, the Buddha was fully awakened, which in Buddhism is defined operationally as no possibility of greed, hatred, or delusion, and I would add heartache, invading the mind and remaining. Okay, that's it. It's irrevocable. It doesn't happen anymore. All right. Wow, that's an extraordinary brain, I think, because, as I said last night, the brain evolved to be hateful, greedy, heartachy, and deluded, because that's what helped our ancestors survive. Right? We have a problem, Houston. What are we going to do about this? So... you know, I'm happy when it works. And the Buddha did not need an MRI to do this. He didn't need this little list of neural factors. On the other hand, here we are today, 2,500 years later, and we know much more about what's going on in the black box of the brain when people do various practices. Right? So often what you'll find is you'll find yourself understanding more deeply why a traditional practice works. Or maybe you'll be thinking up a method and knowing something about how the brain works, and then you find yourself reading about that exact same method in an article in Tricycle, a traditional Zen practice, let's say, and you realize, wow, they knew this 1,000 years ago. They didn't have updated modern neuropsychological evolutionary information, but they stumbled upon it because it worked, right? So I think that happens quite often. There's a lot about meta-practice, long-hearted, wholehearted, deliberate encouragement of compassion and kindness that really works in terms of the brain. Specifically, first, feeling safer really reduces vigilance and also reduces activation of the sympathetic nervous system, the stress response, fight or flight, reactive portion of the nervous system. Because when we don't feel threatened, we don't need to be scanning everywhere, and we don't need to protect or brace or guard ourselves against some kind of threat. It's interesting how much traditional teaching is about finding a place of seclusion. Or if you think of the metaphor and perhaps the actuality of the Buddha's own night of awakening, with his back against the Bodhi tree, the tree had his back, from which most lethal threats come for animals in the wild, from behind, you know, ambush predators coming from behind. The Bodhi tree had his back so he could feel safer, because it forced Mara, the metaphor or actuality of the forces of darkness and delusion, to come at the Buddha from the front, where he could deal with it. So feeling safer and safer is really promotive of bringing the cognitive resources that are being expended in the mind and therefore the brain, bringing them in from the battlements, you know, where the sentries are scanning for threat vigilantly, bringing them in internally so they can be allocated toward greater steadiness of mind. That's the safety factor. Yeah?
Well, this is so embarrassing and frustrating, but half the time I fall asleep in the middle of the meditation. And so I feel like I haven't gotten what I should be getting after.
Right. Okay. Well, I'll speak to that, and then I'll say a little more about the safety thing and then a couple other things. Yeah, she said that she falls asleep quite often, right? Mm-hmm. Again, you're speaking for more than one person in the room, I'm sure. And, yeah, me included. And I have a couple thoughts about that. One is it's often an indicator that we just need more sleep. You know, as many people have pointed out, many people worldwide, and certainly Americans, are chronically sleep deprived. And sleep's really, 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 really important. So that's one thing. Maybe it just means we need to need more sleep. And the truth is, maybe, honestly, spacing out, zoning out, kind of getting drowsy in meditation is, you know, kind of the cheap equivalent of sleep. It's not exactly equivalent, but it's kind of helpful. So maybe there's a place for just letting it happen sometimes. But often I would go on retreat, and one of the breakthroughs for me on one of my first retreats was to let myself take a nap during a meditation. Because I'm such a, you know, I'm like a, I want to perform kind of guy. I want to do right and achieve. And so, yeah, and so for me, achieving was napping. I had to reframe it. So that's one. A second is to, you know, sometimes help yourself by standing up, opening the eyes. Tibetan suggestion is to visualize light. Think of things that are energizing or activating that can help stay awake if that's something you want to do. And the last, I think it's perfectly okay to appreciate the fact that a lot of stuff is happening even when we're not consciously aware. Unconsciously, you're hearing the suggestions.
I did hear something.
Yeah, things are working in the mind. It's okay. You know, so that's what I would say about that. And meanwhile, get more sleep. Yeah, there you are. Oh, okay. Okay, well, back to safety. Now, it's often common that when I give that safety suggestion, it might have happened for some people here, it started to make you anxious to feel safer. Because it's when we feel safer that we lower our guard, and that's when they really get you, right? So if that happens, that's okay. It's all right, especially again for people with a trauma history. You know, it makes them nervous to not be nervous. See what I mean? And so if that arose, you know, that's just something to be aware of, and it helps to keep bringing it back to, look, there's no perfect safety in a world that includes old age, disease, and death. Things happen, right? But on the other hand, reasonably, I can usually afford to feel safer than I am right now. Most people are experiencing unnecessary levels of anxiety. If you think of it, in the wild, there are two kinds of mistakes a creature can make. On the one hand, the creature can think there's a tiger in the bushes, but actually there's no tiger there. Or alternately, the creature can think that the coast is clear, but there truly is a tiger about to pounce. Well, what's the cost of the first mistake? Needless anxiety. What's the cost of the second mistake? No more gene copies, right? Right. Rule one in the wild is eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. Right? So, Mother Nature wants us to make the first mistake 1,000 times over to avoid making the second mistake even once. So we go through life with generic, hardwired, paper tiger paranoia, right? Which then is intensified by life history, temperament, culture, politics, and all the rest of that, right? So a few people are not as anxious as they should be, right? There are two mistakes. Our son, for example, wasn't sufficiently anxious about pinning down a bureaucratic detail as he went through college to satisfy a breadth requirement, and he was forced to take an extra class and pay for it out of his pocket because he hadn't fulfilled a breadth requirement for graduation, which he discovered belatedly. Mm-hmm. So So I wish his mom and I wish that he was a little more anxious about some things. But most people in general are needlessly anxious. You can just feel it. There's kind of an ongoing background trickle of anxiety in us. And it's a very powerful practice that I've started making myself do routinely to notice that I'm actually all right right now. Sometimes you're not actually all right now. Something terrible has happened, there's overwhelming pain, whatever. But most of the time we actually are all right now. Maybe we weren't all right in the past, maybe we won't be all right in the future, but in this moment, we're actually all right now. And noticing that and helping the knowing of that and the felt sense of that sink in over and over and over again is a great way to undo anxiety for its own sake, because anxiety is unpleasant, and to reduce the priming that has us defend ourselves or be aggressive toward others. And also the priming that leads us to be distractible. Because when we're a little anxious, we're more distractible, and therefore we have less steadiness of mind. Yep?
I had a problem with feeling safer. I didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
That's the only thing in that list that I felt myself struggling with.
Yeah.
Is there a mental state that I could get into that helped me with that?
Yeah, thanks for saying that. She said that the safety one, number 4, was the hardest one. And it's a difficult one for many people. So first of all, sometimes a suggestion, so context here. I think there are 3 major sort of movements or things to do in healing, personal growth, well-being, and spiritual practice. The 3 things are, first, to be with what's there, to simply be aware of it, right? Ideally, to hold it in spacious awareness, to experience the experience, feel the feelings, bear the pain, know what it is, know thyself, et cetera, et cetera. Awareness, mindfulness, awareness. Great. The second major movement or dynamic is around releasing, around letting go. The Buddha used language often of abandonment, dropping. Ajahn Chah, the Thai teacher, no longer alive, Ajahn is an honorific, like rabbi. Ajahn Chah, the main teacher, really, of Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, several other teachers that are really important and central for the movement of the Theravadin strand of Buddhism, sometimes mistakenly called Vipassana, because Vipassana just means insight. All lineages of Buddhism appreciate insight. But that said, you know, that kind of Jack Kornfield, Spirit Rock, IMS, Gaia House strand of Buddhism, the kind of core teacher of that is Ajahn Chah. So he's a wonderful teacher. He's really worth reading. Like Being Dharma, for example, is a really good compendium of his teachings. Anyway, Ajahn Chah has a saying. If you let go a little, you'll have a little happiness. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of happiness. If you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. So there's a lot of focus on letting go. That's the second main movement. Especially, let's say, with painful material or problematic desires. Or, as I said last night, the second, third, fourth, and fifth darts we throw at the phenomena of life in addition to the unavoidable first dart of inescapable discomfort. You know, this is the stuff we do. There's a place for letting it go. Right? That's the second main movement. That's also, by the way, the bulk of Western psychotherapy. Clinical psychology is about the second phase of, for example, cognitive therapy is about letting go of pathological thoughts, wrong beliefs of various kinds. We let go sometimes through insight. We realize that we're transferring into the present some turbocharged reaction from childhood, some distorted view from childhood. We try to let that go, right? We let go of emotions through venting, through imagery work. Relaxation is a kind of bodily letting go of tension. You see, there's a lot under this heading of releasing. It's the second major movement. Okay? The third major movement is the cultivation of whatever's positive. Pragmatically positive. Often it feels pleasant, but it doesn't always feel pleasant. Sometimes the cultivation of what's positive feels unpleasant, and yet it's still positive to do it. For example, serious exercise doesn't necessarily feel good when you're tired and you're jogging and you've got another mile to go, but but you know it's a positive thing, so you try to help yourself continue to do that. So you see these three great movements, and you can see them embedded in the Noble Eightfold Path in right or wise mindfulness, in terms of the first one being awareness. And then in right effort or wise effort, you can see the second and third movements present, the releasing of what's problematic and the cultivation of what's helpful. Right? In six words, those three great movements are let be, let go, and let in. The first is to just be with what's there. The second and third are to work with what's there. I think of those two, in a sense, now I'm collapsing the second and third into one, being with and working with, are the two great wings of spiritual practice, healing, everyday well-being, and personal growth. Okay? The bird needs two wings to fly. Buddhism is actually very much about the second wing of working with. And there's been a lot of emphasis as Buddhism has come into the West, and also as mindfulness has moved into Western psychology and psychotherapy, really focuses on the first wing of being with, of letting be, of ordinary awareness. You see that a lot also in terms of the non-dual traditions as they've moved into the West. Just be with it, okay? And yet, there's still a lot to be said for the working with phase. You know, the pulling of weeds and planting of flowers in the garden of the mind and therefore the brain. And my own personal opinion is that the being with wing of practice has been overemphasized as Buddhism has moved into the West the last 20, 30 years. There's too much of an emphasis on mindfulness alone, and too much of an emphasis on mindfulness alone in psychotherapy world. The Buddha was a major yogi. He worked with what's there a lot. He was very focused on bhavana, cultivation, where we let go of what's problematic, and we draw in what's increasingly positive. Me, I think both wings are important, right? Personally, I think the primary one is the left one, not just because of my politics, but anyway, is the being with wing, you know, because sometimes you can't work with what's there. You're just stuck. You're totally plugged in. You're totally reactivated. Something's overwhelming. It's right there. But we can always be aware of what's there. We can always disidentify from it, observe it, engage Freud's observing ego, pull ourselves out of the horror film and sit back 20 rows and look at it. We can always do that. You can't always change what's on the screen. You can't always work with what's on the screen, but we can always step back and observe. Okay. But I think that this other wing is also very, very important too. Yeah. So when we're doing these kind of practices, like trying to help ourselves feel safer, let's say, we're here doing that working with wind. We're also observing it. We're seeing what happens. We're being with what happens. We're trying to cultivate awareness of what happens, some penetrating insight into what happens. But we're also trying to actively make something happen. And sometimes it just doesn't work. Sometimes it's like trying to light a fire with wet wood. It just isn't going to happen. It can be kind of frustrating. That's one reason why I think that as Buddhism came to the West, especially the sort of the Zen strand of it and Theravadan / Vipassana Buddhism, there was a lot of emphasis on just being with what's there, because Westerners in particular can be very goal-directed and ambitious, and if they can't make something happen, they get mad at themselves, feel self-critical, and tend to give up, right? Or just go somewhere else. So I think that's maybe why some of those teachers, perhaps correctly, thought as a kind of strategy, don't focus on the right effort, wise effort, piece of the puzzle, focus more on the right mindfulness piece of the puzzle. Okay, but at least at this point, I think we can appreciate the pitfalls in mindfulness alone, or the pitfalls in wise effort alone, and find, you know, a middle way that includes both wings to let the bird fly. So in that context, then, we try to make something happen. And often it's informative if we can't make something happen, because that tells us, aha, that's an important issue for me. That's an important thing for me to work with, maybe around feeling safer. So that could be the case. And if you had a particular difficulty with any one of the others up there, that could be where there's a lot of gold in those hills. That might be where there's a lot of opportunity for you. This may not be the time yet to go after that one for various reasons, but on the other hand, it might be, because there could be some real opportunity for you. So now, specific to how to feel safer, I thought about it a lot because I think it's a really important issue. For one, I've really come to appreciate more and more and more how we evolved to be scaredy cats or scaredy monkeys, you know, because confident, you know, monkeys, they got eaten. Right? The ones that were nervous and paranoid and kind of cranky, they passed on their genes. Right? They had grandchildren that survived to pass on their own genes too. So it's normal to be this way. It's very deep in us to be this way. So I've really come to appreciate, whoa, fear, anxiety is probably the first emotion that an animal ever experienced in our evolutionary path, you know, from the first vertebrates, you know, early fishes, and then moving on to, you know, reptiles and then mammals that branched off 200 million or so years ago. The very earliest animals that started having some kind of emotion, it would be very sensible for the first emotion to be fear, because we got to keep these animals alive. We got to avoid threat. Rule one, you know, eat lunch today, don't be lunch today. So fear is really deep. Okay, so a variety of ways. One is to rationally notice that you're actually okay. Just remind yourself, look around the room, it's protected, there are people around you, you can afford to feel safer. Another one is the one just before it, which is why I do it in that order, to feel cared about. Because for us, as we evolved in the Serengeti, exile was a death sentence, right? You got voted off the island, you were dead, you could not survive. So feeling protected, feeling included, feeling part of the tribe, that's a way in to feel safer, very important. Another one is to feel stronger. Often people talk about, like, I can't trust you, or I can't trust life, or I can't trust the world. Well, and the way it's talked about, it's as if life is threatening out here. And somebody's life is threatening out here. There are people that are threatening, circumstances that are threatening. Okay. But very often what it really means is, I don't feel strong enough in here. I don't feel resourced enough in here to deal with what life brings. So if we build up a sense of resourcing in here, a sense of strength in here, that can also help us feel safer in the world, more kind of confident wherever we go. It's like the turtle. You know, we take our protections with us wherever we go. And there are ways into feeling stronger. For example, bringing up a body memory of feeling strong. I'll bring up times I've been in the wilderness. I'll bring up times I've always stood up for somebody, an episode with our daughter and kind of a creepy seventh grade math teacher who liked the girls that he taught a little too much. And stuff like that, you know, that will bring it up for me. Whatever brings it up for you, even the last repetition, lifting weights, some willfulness, some sense of determination, all that are ways to help oneself feel safer and safer and safer. Okay. Hopefully that wasn't too much on that one point. But I also wanted to create this frame of, you know, letting be, letting go, and letting in. Being with what's there, releasing what's there, and replacing what's there. You know, which are three great movements. Okay? I'm going to say a word or two about a couple others and then dive into the whole not-self material. Feeling cared about, often that stirs up for people feelings of not being cared about. Not being properly cared about by the one you want to care about you, right? And that's very natural. As best one can, when one's in the working with wing of practice, trying to put logs on the fire that are helpful, you notice the obstruction. Obstructions are natural. Be with it. Maybe investigate it for a while. But at the point that there's no more value in investigating it, go back to the positive practice, whatever it was that you started with, that, you know, triggered the obstruction. Okay? In this case, feeling cared about. It also helps to appreciate that the ones who care about you are, as John Wellwood says, perfect love, imperfect relationships, right? There may be problems in the personality, there may be difficulties in the relationship, but behind that, there is a lovingness coming your way, an appreciating coming your way. That's being filtered through an imperfect screen, but it's perfect lovingness, perfect appreciation. So any comments about this one, about the feeling cared about one? Great, thanks. Thank you for that, too. You use the words right now. That's a cue for you.
Keep me in the moment.
Those two words, right now.
Yeah.
Good.
And the other thing is that I really recognize the loving, caring energy that you have and the people that put this event together. Yeah. And that helps me feel cared for.
There are people like you in the world. Like you're sitting here.
Yeah. Oh, I walked in last night. I felt like these are my peeps. This is my tribe. And I was really happy. You know, like, great people. Wow, I get to belong to them. This is good. Sometimes I walk in, it's not my tribe. You know, and that's okay. But it definitely felt like my tribe. And it still does. Yeah. Yeah, thank you for saying that. And to build on that, on the feeling cared about, again, the frame here, in this kind of way I'm talking about it, you know, these three main movements, and then I'm speaking of the third, where we're trying to cultivate positive factors. In that frame, it's great to be resourceful and enterprising and to be an agent, to be a hammer rather than a nail, to not be passive about it, to look for opportunities, to put positive logs in the fire, particularly in a context that we understand, as I talked at some length last night about, and I'll just be super succinct right now, to appreciate the degree to which the brain is biased toward the negative. Right? And it's biased toward reactivity based on very, very minimal triggers. Any kind of sense of threat, any kind of sense of frustration, disappointment, or obstruction, any kind of sense of social rejection or social impediments, boom, the brain is here on a hair trigger, locked and loaded to go into its reactive mode. Very, very, it's easy for the brain to tip into hatred, greed, heartache, and delusion. Right? So it's in that context where we respect that power of the dark side of the force, right? We are active on our own behalf. Specifically in this case, for me, looking around for lots of modest yet genuine examples of being cared about broadly defined. I think of the guys who are in the deli across the street where I've been going for 6 years. They're not my tribe. And yet we joke, we talk about the San Francisco Giants, you know, I'm going to get my usual chicken salad today or not. Am I going to walk on the wild side and have a sandwich? You know, stuff like that. I feel cared about. I feel included. We're just shooting the breeze, but there's a warmth there. That's good. That's okay. Neighbors, relatives, friends, coworkers, just, you know, imperfect relationships, yet a perfect moment of caring, even if it's mild. Those are really great opportunities. Just feeling part of a group of people, kind of hanging out. I was, you know, hey, it's, I don't know if women do this, men sometimes do it, joking with a guy standing next to me in the urinal. It's like a connection. I'm taking it in. If we're on our own side, which is really foundational, you know, as the Buddha said on his deathbed, this was his final teaching. It's been translated various ways, but the essence of it is, make a lamp unto yourself. Don't rely on authority. You know, rely on yourself. No one will do it for you. He says repeatedly, I've told you what you need to know. There are trees. There are abandoned huts. Go and do your work. You know, it's up to us to do this. So it's in this context of being on our own side, being enterprising, being resourceful, being for ourselves, and appreciating the preciousness of human life and its fragility, and the fact that very few of us know when we will cross that line, as Stephen Levine talks about and wrote a beautiful book about, where we have 1 year to live. Most of us do not know when we will have only 1 year to live. 365 days, then 364, then 363. You know, how will we use this life? Before that line and then after that line, right? So it's in that context that I'm looking for these kind of supplies. Avoiding the pitfall of greed and grasping and clinging, right? That's problematic. And yet, just because there are pitfalls doesn't mean we don't walk the trail. We just try not to fall off the side. Okay. Including looking for those social supplies. So there was someone over there? Yeah.
I know the focus is on the brain and the neurons, but we keep asking, what about the heart?
Yeah.
And I know that the heart is pretty important in terms, for example, from science, like heart rate variability is the best measure of health, well-being, and mortality there is. So it seems like the heart needs to, I'd like to hear something about the heart.
Yeah.
How this
connects. Great. Okay. Did you all hear what he said there? That's good. That's very important. Okay. So, a couple of things. So first, how do we mean the word heart? Do we mean it physically or metaphorically? Either way, I think you're meaning it more physically, right?
Yes.
Or maybe both. So here it gets very interesting. So a couple things here, is just to bring everybody into it. He talks about heart rate variability. He spoke about heart rate variability. The idea is that the heart beats, so there's an interval between the beats. So if you're having 60 beats a minute, let's say, on average that interval is 1 second long. But the heart is not a machine in a physical sense, or a machine in a metallic sense. You know, it's not like a metronome. So the interval actually is continually changing between the beats, even if we're averaging 60 beats per minute. So the interval might change more like 1 second, 1.1 seconds, 1.2 seconds, 1.3 seconds, 1.2 seconds, 1.1 seconds, 1 second, 0.9 seconds, 0.8 seconds, 0.7 seconds, 0.8 seconds, 0.9 seconds, 1 second. See? Like that. As we exhale, the heart rate slows down. As we inhale, the heart rate speeds up. As we exhale, the parasympathetic nervous system, the relaxing, rest and digest, soothing and replenishing wing of the autonomic nervous system takes over. That's exhaling. That's, by the way, I was tricking it when I encourage you to do several long exhalations. That stimulates the parasympathetic nervous system. It's a very quick way to get that relaxation response. It's kind of a trick. Also, relaxing the tongue. The rest and digest system has neurons that innervate the mouth. They're just all over the place. So when we relax the tongue, relax the mouth, that also is a way to stimulate that relaxation response. Okay? So, and on the other hand, the fight or flight stress response, sympathetic nervous system is kind of activating and expending, as it were, is kicked into gear when we inhale and the heart rate speeds up. So this produces this natural variation in heart rate, which is a major marker of health and well-being, right? It's a marker of, for example, a stronger immune system. It's a marker of a better mood. There's an important question, though, as to whether heart rate variability is just a readout on a dashboard, that it's a marker of underlying positive physiological factors, or whether it's actually causal. See the distinction? Is the distinction clear?
Yeah.
And there's not a lot of evidence that heart rate variability itself is causal. There's a lot of evidence that the underlying processes that indicate a strong parasympathetic nervous system, which is linked to the vagus nerve and which is involved with a strong sense of social engagement, those are very helpful things, right? Is that heart rate variability itself that causal? It's probably causal for the health of the heart, particularly after a heart attack. It does seem to have some evidence for that right there. But a lot is sort of an indicator, I think, of some underlying good process. That said, if we, through things like HeartMath, for example, do various practices that create a really large heart rate variability. Basically, large heart rate variability is good. A large degree of variation in the interval between the beats is a good thing. And also smoothly varying change in that interval is a good thing, rather than chaotic change in that interval is a good thing, especially for the heart. It seems to confer a protective benefit to the heart, right? So that's good. That's really good. So then the question, though, becomes, to what extent does what's happening in the heart contribute to heartfelt feelings like love, compassion, kindness, connection, and so forth? Well, this is where it gets a little tricky. Just physiologically, I think there's something on the order of about 40 million neurons whose cell bodies are in the heart. They're neurons, you know, that are involved throughout the body. Okay, well, compare 40 million neurons here to 100 billion neurons inside the skull. Right. And it seems to be the case, for example, you can mess with those neurons in the heart and a person can still, or an animal in a research lab, can still seem to have heartfelt feelings like love or compassion. They can still have releases of oxytocin irrespective of what those particular neurons are doing. Right. So it looks like the primary physical substrate of heartfelt feelings, love, compassion, caring, and kindness, is what is happening physically inside the brain itself. Not so much physically what's happening down here. What's happening down here seems to influence it to some extent. You know, greater heart rate variability is associated with greater sense of experiencing caring and kindness, compassion and love. All right. But on the other hand, what's happening up here has a huge influence over heart rate variability. Right? My own opinion is because the heart sounds good and the brain sounds kind of weird and creepy and cold and heady, you know, people have a kind of sentimentalizing sometimes of what's happening in the heart over what's happening in the brain. For me, at the end of the day, as best we can tell, it's the brain that is constructing the psychological experience, the phenomenology of heartfelt emotions, much more than what's happening in the cardiovascular system. And I'm fine with that. The bottom line, do you feel love?
Yeah.
You know, do we? Are we loving? And I'm also very pragmatic, and I think HeartMath, for example, has made a major contribution here. You know, heart rate variability people and polyvagal theory, working with the vagus nerve, major contribution pragmatically, because a good way in to getting the result in the brain as the final common pathway of the construction of moment-to-moment experiencing, a good way in to getting a good result up here is to use the brain here to fiddle with the breath and to visualize things, to manipulate the heart here, which then feeds back up into the brain. You see that kind of loop? Anyway, so that's my take on that. And none of that diminishes the mystery and the majesty of love. Right? Okay. Okay, gotta keep going. Also, how are you doing with the temperature in here? Maybe because I'm standing on the projector, it's warmer. Is it a little stuffy? Maybe opening a door or window? You okay with that?
Yeah.
You kind of regulate the sound somehow. All right. So, moving on. Anything else on this stuff? Yeah. I'm sorry, say that again?
How long do you think it'll take for our Valentine's Day card to be brain shaped?
Yeah, I think it'll never happen. You know, the brain is kind of, I don't know if you were there last night and I showed a picture of the brain. It looks like rotten cauliflower. It's just mushy. No, I don't think it'll ever happen. I don't think it'll ever happen. And let's also be clear, like, again, I appreciated your comment. Brain science is a baby science. There's so much we don't know. You know what I mean? So much we don't know. And actually, it's a good way into a larger point, which is it's easy to fall in kind of the trap of being brainocentric, right? Well, the brain is connected to the nervous system, which is connected to all the other major bodily systems, the cardiovascular system, the immune system, hormonal system, the musculoskeletal system, GI system, etc. And by extension, out into the natural world. So when I talk about the brain, I really am kind of using it as a shorthand because it's the headquarters of the whole nervous system. For example, a little detail, when the immune system has an inflammatory response, let's say to a toxin or a pathogen or an allergen, like wheat, grain, you know, gluten or dairy, when the immune system has an inflammatory response, first of all, that inflammatory response is throughout the whole body. And second, to produce that inflammatory response, the immune system draws on little chemicals called cytokines. They're little messengers. They zoom around and they trigger an inflammatory cascade, an inflammation. Well, some of those cytokines move up into the brain, right? And they lodge in the brain, particularly in the hypothalamus, part of the brain that's involved as a very central regulator of our deep emotional responses to things, including our mood. And the hypothalamus is the producer of signals to the pituitary gland to release hormones that trigger a hormonal stress cascade. Well, cytokines due to inflammation lodge in the hypothalamus and basically impair its ability to turn off its signals for stress hormones. And as a result, people get depressed. There's what's called the cytokine theory of depression, whereby, as I say, inflammation, immune system activity over time can lower mood. Right? And we know this in a very ordinary sense. I know for me, the key indicator that I might be starting to get a cold is my mood starts going flat. Normally, I'm fairly cheerful just by disposition, and my mood's gone down flat, or even a little mopey. And it's interesting, if you look at the physician's manuals of diagnostic criteria for various ailments, I've been told that if you index across all these lists of symptoms for different diseases or illnesses or health conditions, and you look for the one symptom that shows up the most in all these lists of symptoms, you index across all those maladies, depression is the number one symptom of something going wonky with the nervous system. People wonder why getting sick makes us depressed, right? And it's thought, actually, that it served an adaptive function in evolution, that if a critter is injured or ill, it's good to make it depressed. So it just kind of hunkers down in its little cave, moping around, but at least it's unexposed to predators in a weekend and can escape. Okay, so you can see, again, that's an example through the immune system of the interactive dynamic nature of things. Okay, all right. Good, enough. Oh, positive emotion, I had to say a word about this. All right, so you may know, well, pointing the other way, here we are. Okay. Hopefully this is not boring. Is it boring?
No.
I don't know. Okay. A little too much inside baseball. But I don't know. I just think it's so cool, like under the hood, you know? What's going on in there? Anyway. All right. So here we have the Buddha, right? Perfectly prepared to starve himself nearly to the point of death, you know, in his own process, 6-7 year journey toward awakening. There are points in the tradition, in the his own description of his own path. Whereas he puts it, he was so emaciated, he starved himself so much in his pursuit of ascetic practices that his spine stuck out and his ribs stuck out like the rafters of a broken down house, right? That he could touch his spine through pushing on his stomach, you know. It was just so emaciated. Well, here's someone perfectly prepared to do that in a tradition that's perfectly prepared to do that. All right. And yet, interestingly, the so-called jhana factors. The jhanas are these four non-ordinary states of deep absorption that constitute the right concentration or wise concentration element of the Eightfold Path of Practice in Buddhism. Right concentration is defined as these four non-ordinary, you're not in Kansas anymore when you're experiencing the jhanas, states of awareness. How do we get there? Traditionally, there's said to be five jhana factors. Okay, five factors of the jhanas. What are the five factors? Applying attention and sustaining attention. You may recall that I set that up in my setup for paying attention for 5 minutes to object of awareness. I said apply attention to the beginning of each exhalation and sustain attention throughout, and then apply attention to the beginning of each inhalation and then sustain attention throughout. Those are two of the five factors right there. The third factor is rapture, bliss. Pali word, Pali is the language of early Buddhism. The word is piti, bliss. Wow. Interesting, bliss also is one of the seven factors of awakening. Wow. Bliss. In a tradition that is perfectly prepared to be disenchanted by life, perfectly prepared to be present with what's unpleasant, in a balanced and equanimous, and in a good sense of the word, kind of indifferent way, is valuing bliss as a means to the end of awakening in the seven factors list and in the five factor list of the jhana factors, is valuing bliss as a factor of profound steadiness of mind, which is the prerequisite for the deepest, most liberating insights generally within the Buddhist view. The fourth jhana factor is joy. The Pali word is sukha. Pali is kind of like the poor person's version of Sanskrit. It's like Low German and High German. Pali's like Low Sanskrit, High Sanskrit. Anyway, Sanskrit, as you know, is the root of the Indo-European languages. Well, the word sukha is also shares the root with the word sucrose, or sugar. Sukha is sweet. There's a sweetness to this joy, which is on a spectrum running from happiness to contentment to tranquility, which are all positively valenced. Well, here too, we have a factor of steadiness of mind being happiness. Huh? Right? And then the fifth factor, by the way, for the jhanas is called singleness of mind or unification of awareness, things really coming together. By the way, a way into that fifth jhana factor, Pali word ekagata, unification of consciousness, unification of mind, It's kind of like everything appears in awareness as a whole gestalt, as a unified gestalt, one unified percept that integrates sounds, sights, thoughts, etc. in this moment. It's one whole thing. A way into that are those panoramic perspectives that create that kind of open, spacious awareness. Because we're in that open, spacious awareness, everything appears at once, moment after moment after moment. So it's a nice way in to kind of put some logs on the fire that helps strengthen that fifth factor, that factor of unification of awareness. Small point for those who would be interested in that, perhaps. Well, why in the world would bliss and joy help steady the mind? It has to do neurologically with a dopamine mechanism that's, I think, pretty cool. So here's how it works. If we are steadying the mind, we are zeroed in on one object of attention, right? Let's say the sensations of breathing. To be zeroed in on that, we need to keep foregrounding in an awareness and not be swept away by the other chatter in the mind, right? The other things pulling on our attention. How does the brain accomplish that? Well, the neural substrates of consciousness are spread throughout the brain, but there's some major networks that are really central for being conscious, being aware. And in the upper outer regions of the brain, in the prefrontal cortex, there are substrates of working memory. Working memory is kind of like the mental chalkboard. It's, you know, what it's this field of what we're particularly focused on right now. So we've got these neural substrates here, right? For us to sustain focus on a particular object of attention, the sensations of breathing, let's say, or the teacher in fifth grade explaining long division, or whatever it is, what I'm saying right now, perhaps, what has to happen is a kind of neurological gate that keeps those neural substrates closed to new inputs so that they can continue to represent, moment after moment after moment, some particular object of attention, such as the sensations of breathing. This is the operationalization of steadiness of mind in terms of these particular neural substrates. What keeps that gate closed? Because when the gate is closed, that's how we steady the mind. So as meditators, or as anyone who's wanting to be able to really stay with what's useful for oneself, let's say, it is helpful to understand how that gate works. Okay? Here's how the gate works. It's held in place by steady dopamine. When dopamine levels drop, the gate opens. When dopamine levels spike, the gate opens. What does dopamine do? It's a neurotransmitter, and it tracks reward. So when rewards are steady and typically moderate, the gate stays closed. When rewards drop, the gate opens. We start looking around for other rewards. Or when the gate, or when reward opportunities spike, we stop looking for rewards here, and we look for better rewards over there. Imagine a monkey in a tree. In this tree, I'm a monkey in a tree, eating bananas in this tree. It's all good. Plenty of bananas in this tree. No need to look around for other trees. Steady dopamine. I'm not looking around for other trees. But if the supply of bananas in this tree declines, then I need to look around for other rewards. So the gate of dopamine opens. You know, dopamine levels drop. The gate opens. And I look for other trees. Okay? On the other hand, if I'm eating bananas in this tree, it's all good, and then some cute monkey swings into a branch nearby. Whoa, how you doing? Forget the bananas, what's your sign? You know, what's up, right? It's a greater reward. Dopamine levels spike, gate of awareness pops open, forget the bananas, got a new stimulus, more opportunity over here. Okay? That's a very ingenious mechanism, isn't it? Well, think about it. What do high levels of positive emotion, bliss, or joy do for us? For one, they're rewarding. And if they're high, they're at the top of their range. You cannot get a spike. There's a ceiling effect. If you're already just awash in well-being, even if it's a subtle state of mind like tranquility, but you're just completely given over to this so peaceful, pleasant mind like a mountain pond, perfectly still, untroubled. This feels so good, undisturbed. It's really hard for anything else to penetrate. Breath after breath, the beautiful breath. you know, devoted to the breath. Ajahn Brahm, in his great book, Mindfulness, Bliss, and Beyond, you know, he's a real jhana master, a real teacher of concentration, talks about the beautiful breath, you know, devotion to the breath. I love you, breath. Here's the wash in positive emotion. Loving kindness, metta practice, is a positive emotion. You're getting a 2-for-1 there. With metta, you know, 3-for-1, actually, as I think about it, you're feeling cared about, because feeling cared about or caring, any kind of social engagement is going to make us feel better. Metta practice, because love feels the same, whether it's going out or coming in, right? So metta practice gives us that, helps us feel safer because we're protected, and it's luscious in its positive emotion. It's kind of cool, right? So you see how that works? Isn't that amazing? Mm-hmm. Kind of neurologically, yeah. You're talking, you mean what's happening when the attention is just getting drawn to and caught up in a negative, like we keep revisiting this quarrel or a trauma?
Or seeking it out in other people. Or
like being fascinated with negativity in others?
Yes, engage in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a great counterexample, and it's kind of puzzling to people. Like, why would we do it if it's not rewarded?
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Or even think of versions of it like, you know, sadomasochism, right? Or masochism, you know, seeking out.
Well, they just find a level playing field bored.
Yeah.
And so they seek out and engage. If they can't create that drama in their life, they'll seek out someone else.
Yeah. Yeah, right. That's good. Well, I think you're naming it right there. You know. So you're asking me a little bit about that.
Yeah, why would
we do? Yeah.
And that's familiar.
Right? Yeah. Well, briefly, one, I think you're very usefully naming some of the reasons. For one, it's stimulating. And people crave stimulation. Now, people vary in the degree to which they want stimulation. We all have a kind of inner stimostat. Some people want more stimulation than others, right? People at kind of the jackrabbit, spirited / ADHD end of the temperamental spectrum, they just need more stim. They start feeling really bad when they're not getting stim. People more at the kind of turtle, cautious, soft, and sometimes rigid, anxious end of the temperamental spectrum, they don't like a lot of stim because it's overwhelming and spooky, right? So yeah, so if you're more at the upper end of the spectrum, you know, causing trouble is very stimulating. I see a lot of kids in my practice, you know, more toward typically the spirited, aggressive, ADHD end of the spectrum, the jackrabbit kids, and hey, if all else fails, create trouble. Pick a quarrel with your seatmate, you know, or just drive the teacher crazy, because it's kind of fun to watch grown-ups completely lose it, right? It really is. You know, you all right? Okay, or get into gossip or cause, you know, like Gossip Girl. Oh, my God, what a show. You know, like, every so often I'd see bits of it when my daughter was watching it. Please, well, don't take lessons from these people. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, right?
Yeah, or in journalism, if it bleeds, it leaks. Why are we drawn to that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so part of it is stimulating. Part of it is because it's honestly what we're familiar with. I think part of it, too, is the devil you know compared to the devil you don't. In a weird way, it binds anxiety to focus on something negative. Because rather than having free-floating anxiety that just is very unpleasant, at least I know what I'm scared about. So I think there are different reasons. And then there are weird ways it does get kind of messed up in the brain, that the brain starts associating reward with that painful experience, and that can be kind of problematic. So it's a mess. All right.
But don't you still get the dopamine response?
You can, yeah.
So physiologically, you're getting the response.
Yeah, exactly. Like, why do people want to eat hot chili peppers?
Yeah.
Things like that. Like, in a weird way, it can become rewarding. Yeah, exactly right. Okay, I'll keep going. But you see, so some points, large and small. For one, these are factors that do help steady the mind. And, you know, I've been meditating quite a while, off and on, mostly on lately, and I'll still do these sometimes, just to kind of warm myself up, kind of warm up the circuits, especially if my mind's wandering all over the place and it's not settling fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. Second point, it illustrates the ways in which mind and brain co-arise. We're seeing a parallel between the movements of mental activity and the movements of neural activity and vice versa. Broader point, is the illustration of resourcefulness. I'm just trying different things. The Buddha offered literally dozens and dozens. Sometimes people count well over 100 different techniques of various kinds for different people with different issues at different times. So we're going to try different things to help ourselves along the way. Okay? All right, great. And if we're going to do what we're talking about here, which is to work with this territory of, self and who am I, to do that, it really helps to kind of steady the mind because it's very easy to get spun out around this topic and distracted about it. Okay. All right? Ready to move on? Okay, great. So I'm going to kind of blur through the next several slides just to mention them in passing. They'll be in the slide set I'll send you. In the interest of time, I think I'll just go through these. Basically, meditation of all the various mental trainings of one kind or another, it's been studied more than any other in terms of its impact on the brain, which is kind of cool. So there's a real big body of literature about meditation and mindfulness at this point in terms of its neurological consequences and benefits, physiological benefits, and more broadly, mental health benefits. All right, so in the interest of time, I'll just mention these slides and kind of go through them. I covered, I think, most of these points last night. Really fast telomeres are these tips of strips of atoms on the very tips of the molecule of DNA. As we age, cells divide again and again and again, so molecules of DNA have to be replicated. As they get replicated over and over, these strips of atoms called telomeres shrink, and that shrinking of the telomeres is associated with age-related diseases. Well, interestingly, a recent study showed that at least when people did a 3-month concentration retreat, question is, of course, whether this benefit applies to more kind of everyday, homespun forms of meditative practice. But at least in a 3-month concentration retreat, the meditators compared to matched controls, who also were longtime meditators but were waitlisted for the retreat, preserved the length of these telomeres on the end of, molecules of DNA, which is a pretty remarkable benefit if you think about it from something like meditation. Okay? There's a lot of physiological benefits from meditation other than what goes through the brain, strengthens the immune system. I think, by the way, a lot of the pathways for the benefits of meditation are through stress reduction, which means that other methods as well that get you the same stress reduction benefit would probably have those benefits that are achieved through that pathway. I don't want to just privilege meditation. There are other ways into these benefits. On the other hand, I think there are unique benefits for meditation. And meditation is, it's like a 10-for-1 deal. You get a lot of different kinds of benefits from doing meditation. All right? Okay. And then in terms of known psychological benefits, by the way, these bullet points are a summary of research studies, high-quality research, so it's solid, et cetera. A lot of benefits psychologically, attention, seems to reduce the vulnerability, for example, at the bottom there, for relapse to depression. MBCT stands for mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Interesting, by the way, when we meditate, we tend to strengthen the insula, part of the brain that's involved in tuning into ourselves. Well, when we strengthen that part of the brain, it also gets stronger for tuning into the feelings of others. Yeah. Okay? Okay, great. So then, self. So now, I'm going to think about how to do this. I think what I'm going to do is do lunch a little earlier than I had initially thought. I thought about doing lunch in about 20 minutes at 12:45, but I think I'll start lunch a little sooner. Is that okay? It won't freak anyone out. Might alter my lunch plans a little bit. The rice may not be ready, but I think it'll be okay. Because I'll get this piece out of the way, then we'll do lunch, and then we'll come back and do an experiential practice. All right? And it'll give me something to think about during lunch. So I'll do it in this sequence. Okay, great. So, self in the mind. Some definitions first. For me, key definitions, key distinctions. First, persons. The person is a unique individual body-mind with a history that's distinct from other persons. Because I think that cups are real, I think that that this body-mind is real in some sense. I think that body-mind right there, that body-mind right there, is real in some sense. That body-mind has the label Abraham. This body-mind, right, if I remember correctly, has the label Rick. Good. These persons are distinct from each other. I think persons have rights, they're entitled to care and concern, and persons have responsibilities, morally speaking. No question about that. A little sidebar, there's this whole conundrum really in Buddhism, because if everything's empty, how, you know, is there a place for guilt or responsibility? Or how can you be moral if there's no there there?
Yeah.
Right? Well, there's a there there. It's just that the there is empty. You know, the there is an eddy in a stream rather than some essentialized essence. Okay. So they're persons. Self, the way I'm going to use that term is quite specifically in the way that it's often used in Western psychology, as that persistent sense of an I inside. The I in I want a cookie, or the me in do you love me, or the mine or my for the little kid in that's my truck. Right? My precious. Right? That one is the one I'm talking about. Right? There's an everyday presumption that is often uninspected. It's just, we just do it. That there is such a one. Okay? And that's what I'm really going to be challenging and going after in this workshop. Often, when you read people writing about self, they conflate person and I. And they presume that there's an I, because there's clearly a self in the sense of there's a person. There is a person. There are experiences that are localized here, distinct from your experiences localized over there. But as we'll explore, just because there's a person, does there need to be a self in the specific meaning that I'm giving it here? The I, the me, the entity. The one looking out through the eyes. See, that distinction is really critical. And then there's awareness. Awareness is the field in which experiences come and go. It's still mysterious in scientific terms how we have conscious experiences, how the pleasant smell of a rose is constructed somehow by the brain as an experience. All right. But basically, it's clear that there is some kind of underlying neural substrate that's involved in moment-to-moment experiencing. Experientially, there's a field of awareness in which things are represented and then they pass away, right? That field of awareness can represent a sense of I, a sense of me. That field of awareness can have a thought, that's my red truck, not your red truck. That's my spouse, not your spouse. Get away. You know, whatever, right? It can represent that. It can represent painful feelings like, ouch, that hurts. I feel disrespected. I feel dismissed here. I feel dismissed here. It can represent that. But here's the thing. The sense of I is just one more content in the field of awareness. It's not inherently much of a problem. Sometimes it becomes a problem, but in everyday life it's not that much of a problem that content arises in awareness and passes away. Like a sound arises in awareness and passes away, a body sensation arises in awareness and passes away, an emotion arises in awareness and passes away. The problem is that we tend to privilege that content above all others. That's problematic. Sometimes what people do is they identify with awareness and they make that their I. The Buddha really argued against that, because as you were probably tracking my walkthrough of the Bahiya Sutta in terms of these five things, you know, the bare apprehension of reality, the sense of things being pleasant or unpleasant, the perception of things, categorizing them, remembering what they are, fourth, other contents of mind and consciousness itself, those are the five aggregates in Buddhism, the five heaps, right, that constitute all of our experience. Well, the last one, consciousness, the Buddha said arose dependently. It wasn't like there was some consciousness that existed prior to that which it represents. The consciousness appears in association with that which it represents, and some faculty, like the ear or the eye, that can apprehend a stimulus and the stimulus itself, that all three of them come together in a moment of contact. Right? So we don't have consciousness in the Buddhist model as this ongoing thing. It arises when it needs to represent something. Okay? And we certainly, in traditional Buddhism, do not have consciousness as some metaphysical ground that somehow produces individual human awareness. Right? So we don't have consciousness as some kind of transcendental field that we can then potentially cling to. We have consciousness, awareness, as an everyday mental phenomenon, not privileged, not special compared to another. Pragmatically, appreciating awareness and relaxing so that there's simply primarily the kind of ongoing baseline awareness of beingness with not much else happening, that's helpful pragmatically, but there's not a privileging of awareness or identification with awareness as me in Buddhism. And yet, again, in non-dual circles, and sometimes in other circles with the language, you will find people identifying with awareness. And then that becomes kind of problematic. All right? So you see what I'm kind of doing? I'm trying to lay the ground for what we're going to do. Yeah, in the back?
So it sounds like you've got a container, an owner, and a field.
The container.
The person is the container, the self is the owner, and the awareness is the field.
Okay. And by owner, I would slip in presumed owner. Okay. Good. In quotes, owner. All right. Yeah, in a sense, that's a fine way to put it. All right. This distinction, by the way, between person and self has been very helpful for me in my own practice and my own deepening insight into this territory. You know, there's no doubt that they're persons. The real question is whether there are eyes. Okay. So we have that. Now let me see if I want to do anything else. I'll do one more thing just before lunch. Okay? So, next slide. The ordinary notion of the I, the quote-unquote self, is that it has four constituting qualities that create, that constitute, that produce. Number one, that it's unified, that it's one thing. There's just one I. Okay? Second, that it's stable. The I am today was the I was yesterday. And the I was when I was 6 years old in summer vacation, running across the field, kicking up my heels and screaming with joy. It's the same I. Right? That's the ordinary notion, the everyday notion. Third, that the I, things happen to it, but it retains its nature no matter what happens to it. It's independent. Right? It's distinct from what happens to it. It's an owner of experiences, distinct from the experiences themselves. Okay? And then last, that the I is the center of identity. It's who we really, really most intimately are. Alright? See, those are the defining qualities. If you read accounts in Western psychology or read accounts in philosophy, basically this is what it boils down to. That the I is unified, stable, independent, and identity. It's the essence of who we are. Okay? This is what's presumed to constitute to create the existence of an I. This is what makes an I exist. Right? Okay. What we're going to explore after lunch is whether this is actually true. So during lunch, and I know Michael and Momo will have some announcements too, I'll just say this. If you can remember to do this from time to time, see what it's like to participate in lunch with as little sense of I as possible. Going all the way back to the Bahia Sutta, what is it like to move through the eating, the listening, the seeing, the smelling, the feeling, the thinking, the emoting, the wanting, the planning, the choosing, the directing, the attending. What is it like to move through that as a sense of person with lots of different things happening, kind of very loosely, in one bag of skin, as Alan Watts talked about it? What's it like to approach lunch like that experientially, rather than having a strong sense of me, myself, and I? And you might even notice, again, a causal frame, processes and causes, flames and fuel. What is it that sometimes causes a growing sense of me, mine? I'll tell you one is you walk out and you put down your lunch and it's gone. Right? That often creates a sense of I or mine. To preview, basically three kinds of causes classically intensify the sense of me or I. One is great opportunity, great threat, or other people. Because that's another thing that tends to constitute a stronger sense of I, you know, an interaction with another person. You're wandering down the street, just kind of floating along, not much sense of I, just kind of rolling along, just kind of aware, not a particular sense of I there. And then suddenly a friend steps out of a store right in front of you, and you start talking. And very quickly, there's often a pretty strong sense of I present. But just so these are pointing out instructions, as it were. Just see for yourself what actually happens as what, in terms of what creates more of a sense of I, or what helps it relax. And one way into this is to kind of gently from time to time help the sense of I relax and see how much you can have lunch. See if you can walk without a strong sense of I. See if you can eat without a strong sense of I. Or see or hear or even think without a strong sense of I. That's an experiment. All right? So, Michael, do you have some announcements?
Yeah. A few reminders. One, if you haven't registered, the first part. Is there anyone who hasn't registered so far?
No one.
Okay. Great, thank you. Also, if you want to sign up for our contact information, there's a contact sheet in the back. You can also do it online, which would have to be better. If you want copies of this recording, these recordings from last night and this weekend, we will send out notices on that list and also on the Yahoo Groups list, which is on the website, whiteheronsangha.org. That's the best way to get these recordings once they're released. We're not sure when we'll be able to release them. Also, if you're going to eat in the picnic area back there, feel free to move the benches. Somebody put them all to the side. They're not required to be that way. Move them as you wish. And also a reminder that on the back table here, there's a basket for contributions. The money that you paid to register covers our costs for rentals and advertising and machinery, et cetera, et cetera. None of that money goes to Rick. All of the money that goes into that basket back there will go to Rick. If you want to show your appreciation for what he's brought us today, if you want to encourage him to continue doing what he's doing, please consider making a donation in the basket back there. Carol?
Yes, please mention that you can make a donation online at the White Heron Sangha website, www.whiteheronsangha.org. There's a donation page. You go to the donation page, and if you want to make it for Rick, then make sure that you indicate in the comment field that it's for Rick. But it's real easy, and then you can use a credit card.
Okay, thank you.
Good. So, so let's take an hour for lunch. I'm told that's an okay amount of time, et cetera. So, how about we start again at 25 to 2? 25 to 2.